is meant to be a refresher for the laws of Ida. And as such, we're going to move through pretty rapidly. I will attempt to translate everything. If I don't translate something and something is not understood, please stop me and ask me to translate. There are five parts to the laws of Nida. Five major parts. We will cover two out of five tonight, most likely, and the other three next week. The five parts are, number one, how does a woman become a Nida? That's number one. I'll do it in chronological order. So how does she become a Nida? Number two, the special harchakos, which means the separations between husband and wife, that apply when she is a Nida. That's the second part. Number three, when she's ready to start counting the seven clean days, the Shiva Nikim, how does one count the seven clean days? That's the third part. The fourth part is going to the mikvah. And the fifth part is Vestos, which is calculations to figure out when to anticipate that she will get her next period. Those are the five parts of Hilchos Nida. The first two, which is how she becomes a Nida, and the separation, the harchakos, between husband and wife while she is a Nida, those are what we'll attempt to cover tonight. That should take most of our time. How does a woman become a Nida? Now, obviously, the Anida is when a woman gets her period, when she menstruates. But in Halacha, there are parameters for this in the Torah. According to the Torah, in order for a woman to be considered a Nida, which means that she becomes prohibited to her husband, there have to be two things. There has to be bleeding from the makar. The makar is the uterus, which means that if there's vaginal bleeding, but it's not coming from the uterus, like for instance, let's say there's a bruise in the vaginal canal, and that's where the blood is coming from, that would not make a woman a Nida. The blood has to come from the uterus. The trick is determining where it's coming from. We assume, if there is blood, that it's coming from the uterus. That's the assumption. Unless we have reason to believe otherwise, and that's a whole discussion in and of itself, but the assumption is it comes from the uterus. So if there's bleeding, we assume it comes from the uterus. That's requirement number one for a woman to be a Nida. There has to be bleeding from the uterus. Number two is that the bleeding has to be accompanied by or preceded by a hargasha. A hargasha literally means a feeling, but it doesn't mean any feeling. It means specific sensations that Chazal, that our sages determined, were indications of Nida bleeding, which means that there could theoretically be bleeding from the uterus, which would not be considered Nida from the Torah, even though there's bleeding. And that would be, if there is no hargasha, there is no sensation. What sensations, what hargashas are we talking about? So the poskim, the rabbis, have three different sensations, three different hargashas that can accompany bleeding that would render a woman a Nida. What are the three? The three are as follows. One possibility is that she senses, she feels the opening of the cervix. She senses the opening of the cervix. That would be one potential hargasha. The other one is that she feels a zivas davarach, which means she feels a flow of moisture, of liquid, inside of her body. That would be number two. And number three would be nizdaza gufa. Her body shakes in a way that is indicative of a nida type bleeding. One of those three sensations has to accompany the bleeding in order for a woman to be considered a nida from the Torah. Now these three sensations are very difficult to feel. They're not obvious sensations. The shaking of the body means a very specific type of shudder or shiver that is accompanied, that goes along with the nida bleeding. And it's a type of feeling which is not really understood exactly what it is. And generally speaking, women do not feel that feeling today. The sensing of the cervix opening up, for a woman to know that her cervix opened up, that would be very, very unusual for a woman to feel that today. That would mean that she somehow felt an internal organ opening up. That's very, very rare that a woman would feel that today. The third one, that to feel a zimas tabalach, to feel moisture flowing from within, that's one that women often claim that they have felt, but upon further discussion, most of the time what they are feeling is the discharge after it has come out of the body, not when it's inside the body. In order to qualify as a zivas davarach, as a sensation that goes along with nida bleeding, she has to feel it when it is inside the body. My training in Hilchos Nida comes from Rabbi Yaakov Hafer in Baltimore. and he's been a rav for many, many years, and is highly acclaimed in the laws of Nida. And Rabbi Heffer told us that over his career, he's only come across 8 or 9 cases where a woman claimed that she had a zivas davarach, that she actually sensed this flow of the discharge inside her body. And after questioning her, he was willing to agree that that's actually what she felt. So what I'm trying to get at is that these three sensations are almost impossible to feel, and they are almost never felt. Which would therefore mean, if you follow the equation, it should come out, therefore, that today no woman is actually a nida from the Torah. Because although there may be vaginal bleeding that comes from the uterus, but it's not accompanied by a sensation. And according to the letter of the law, that would mean that she's not really a nida from the Torah. So when does it ever happen that a woman is a nida from the Torah? So I was taught that there are two exceptions to this rule. One, when I say I was taught, the other one is in Shulchan Aruch. The one that I was taught is that if a woman bleeds, and it's a heavy flow of bleeding, meaning it's a typical flow that would normally be like her period. The way Rabbi Heffer the way he assesses that is it heavy enough that she needs to put on a pad? If the bleeding is that heavy, then we treat it as a de'oraisa, we treat it as a nida from the Torah, even though it's not accompanied by a sensation, because there must have been a sensation, but she just didn't feel it. It must have happened, but it was such a subtle feeling, she didn't notice it. But it must have been there, because obviously this is her period. Who are we kidding? Clearly, this is her period, and therefore she'll be considered a nida from the Torah. That's one case. The other case would be where there's something else going on in that area of the body that would mask the sensation, which means that she may have had one of these sensations, but because there was something else happening, it masked the sensation. What would that be? So there are several examples given in the poskim, in Shulchan Aruch, according to the rabbis, and those examples are, for like if a woman is urinating, b'hatalas me'raglayim. So since the vaginal canal and the urinal tract are right next to each other, so when a woman is urinating, then there can be a sensation in the vaginal canal that she'll miss. She just won't notice it because there's something else happening in that area of the body. So if blood is discovered while she is urinating, we will consider it to be a de'oraisa, we'll consider it to be a nida from the Torah because of the fact that there may have been a sensation, but it was masked. Another example would be if blood is discovered during or immediately after tashmish hamita, after marital relations. Again, because since that area of the body is being stimulated, then it's very likely that there was a sensation, but she missed it because of what was going on. And a third example would be if she's doing, let's say, a bedika, she's doing an internal examination, like we'll have later, during the Shiva Nakim, during the 7 clean days, then we treat a bedika as if it was a d'oraisa, because perhaps during that time there was a sensation, but it was masked, so she didn't notice it. That would be a third case. You would imagine that a related case would be during a gynecological exam. Again, there's something happening in that area of the body that could mask a sensation. So whenever there's something happening in that area of the body and blood is discovered, the question is more serious, because then it can be treated as a d'oraisa, as a nida from the Torah. So those are examples where a woman could be considered nida from the Torah. And therefore, as we'll see in a moment, we'll explain momentarily what should be done in those cases. If blood is discovered and none of the above apply, meaning it's not a flow, it's just a stain, so we don't have the first exception to the rule, and there's nothing else going on in that area of the body, so then she will be considered nida midrabbanan, only from the sages. What's the difference whether she's considered nida from the Torah or from the Rabbanan? The difference is that if it's the Rabbanan, then there are 3 criteria that have to be met in order for her to be a nida. 3 new criteria. In addition to the bleeding from the uterus, there's 3 other criteria that have to be met. What are those 3 criteria? The 3 criteria are, number 1, the stain has to be as large as a gris va'od. How much is a gris va'od? Most rabbis say that it's the size of a penny. The stain has to be at least the size of a penny in order for her to be considered a nida. That's number 1. Number 2, the stain has to be discovered either on the body, on the skin of the body, or on a white item, not on a colored item. If the stain is discovered on a colored item, then she would not be considered a nida. And number three, the third criteria is that the stain has to be discovered on something that is mekabel tumah, something that can become ritually impure. What are things that can become tamei, that can become ritually impure? There are four general items that can become impure. They are people, food, drink, and kalim, utensils. So for all intents and purposes, we're talking about finding it on the person herself. That would be one case. Or finding it on a utensil like clothing. Clothing are considered utensils in the Torah. And so if on a towel or something like that, or on a sheet, those are all considered utensils. So if the blood is discovered and there is no flow and you don't have any of the other examples we had before, then you have to meet these three criteria for her to be a nida. It has to be on white, it has to be as large as a penny, and it has to be on something that is mekabel tumah that can become ritually impure. Practically speaking, what cannot become impure, what is not mekabel tumah? For instance, toilet paper. Toilet paper is disposable, it is not considered a keli, therefore it is not mekabel tumah. Question?
Yeah, what were the four in that can become
impure? People, food, drink, and utensils. Kalim. That's the four categories. Now, once these three criteria are met, and she becomes a nida from the Rabbanan, then there is no difference between a nida from the Torah and a nida from the Rabbanan. The only difference is, how simple is it for her to become a nida? Do you have to meet these other three criteria or not? But once she enters the category of nida, once those criteria are met, then she is a regular nida like any other nida, whether she got her period or whether it was a stain that was the size of a penny on white clothing. Either way, she is the same nida, which means you're going to go through the same process of Shiva and Nekim of the seven clean days, the same harchakos, the same separations while she is a nida, and when she goes to the mikvah, she'll make a bracha, just like she does when she's a nida from the Torah. There will be no difference once she becomes a nida. The difference is only manifest in how she becomes a nida. Yes? Yeah, we'll get to that. Yeah, I just haven't mentioned the 5 days yet, but you're correct. We'll get to that. That'll be most likely next week. That will incorporate into the 7 clean days. Okay, so those are the two ways of becoming a nida, either from the Torah or from the Rabbanan. Now, as a result of this, because of one of the cases I mentioned before, and this is a common shaila, it's a common question, would be a woman who is urinating and discovers blood in the toilet mixed in with the urine. That is a serious shaila, it's a serious question. When that happens, a rav should be consulted. Because there, it's a daraisa, it could be it's from the Torah, and then you wouldn't have all of these loopholes that I'm mentioning if it's a darabana. So that's a serious question that should be brought up. If a woman has a gynecological exam, preferably, it should be found out before the exam what the doctor is going to do, and a rav should be consulted before the exam to know whether or not precautions should be taken. Now, if a woman is pregnant and she is going for an exam, any typical things that they do will not render her a nida. So you don't have to worry in that particular situation. But if they're going to do anything unusual or anything out of the ordinary, a rav should be consulted preferably beforehand so you don't have any problems later. That would be the best thing. If a woman goes to the bathroom and then she wipes and she discovers blood on the toilet paper, so now it depends. As I mentioned, toilet paper is not mekabel tumah. It doesn't become tameh, and therefore, if it's only derabanan, then she will not be tameh. She will not be a nida. It's only derabanan if the blood is discovered after urinating. If it's discovered during urinating, then she is tameh. Then we wouldn't have that loophole of the fact that the cloth, that the toilet paper is not mekabel tumah. That won't be a loophole in that case. And so, if a woman would wipe immediately after finishing, then it would be so close to the time that she is involved in the urination that it will be considered a daraisa. It will be considered nida from the Torah. If she does what is normal, which waits a couple of seconds before she wipes, then it will be considered derabanan because it didn't happen right away after the urinating. And therefore, she would not become tame because the cloth is not the toilet paper is not the kabel tumah. And so, Some rabbanim will instruct women to wait a few seconds before wiping. Practically speaking, the amount of time that one would have that she would have to wipe in order to become tamei immediately would be os yom. That's what the Gemara calls it, which really means right away. And the only time it could really come up is if a woman is in a big rush, and she's actually holding the toilet paper ready right away when she's finished to wipe, and then finish. That's where the question could come up. But under normal circumstances, if she discovers blood on toilet paper, then she will not become tamei. Although it is a good idea, anytime blood is discovered, to speak to a rav, because even if that particular instance did not make her a nida, but you want to know how to prepare for the future to keep it from happening, or what should be done. So it's always good when blood is discovered, even if you know she's not a nida, to consult a rav. But if you're not sure, you should certainly consult a rav. Yes. That's right. Right. So what? Right.
So when a rav, you still advise that a rav be consulted when it's almost certain that it's a urinary tract?
I would still consult the rav. You are right that very often that will be a reason why a rav will say it's okay. But I would still consult the rav because there can be a difference in the way that it's discovered. But you are correct that that is a way that would be that a rav would look for to say that it would be okay. Yeah. That would be another example. No, well, I would hope that the first time she calls a rav, the rav would instruct her what to look for, etc. But if a rav has never been spoken to, it would be a good idea to speak to him. Yeah.
The mechanism of action for the, for instance, the period of sloughing up all the tissue in the uterus versus IUD, which is the uterus, and that occasionally, I talk to the doctors, that occasionally comes with problems.
Practically speaking, uterine bleeding, we don't differentiate between any of them. If there's uterine bleeding, she's going to become a nida. If there is an exceptional case, you should speak to a rav. But practically speaking, most of the time, we're not going to differentiate.
So it's not like a definition of...
That's right.
A period is a slipping of uterus.
That's right.
Medically,
that's right.
An IUD is a little weird.
That's right. It's not going to differentiate.
Yeah.
Go ahead. We saw that blood came out because she sees it in the toilet.
Right.
And when it's mixed with the urine, then it's daraisa. So then it's irrelevant where you discover it. As long as you know the blood came out, she can become tough. That's right. So the reason why you consult with the rav is because in the description he will understand whether it came out together or separate, etc. And he'll be able to rule what to do in that particular case and whether there's anything to be toilet on her or to get around it. But there'll be things that a rav will do. He'll ask questions to hear if there's a way out. But if there's no way out, that will make her tough. Theoretically, that is better. It's practically difficult for anybody to do. That's, you know, natural. Some say that it's better to use colored toilet paper in order to avoid the question. But practically, since toilet paper is not mekabel tuma, it will be okay. There are those that say that this criterion of an item that is mekabel tuma, some disagree with it. In order to be yotzei kol hadeis, in order to fulfill all the different opinions, one is better off without discovering it in the first place. So that's why colored toilet paper is theoretically better, but but I don't believe, unless Rabbi Feldman requires it, I don't believe that the post can run that way. I don't think it's appropriate. Okay. Any more questions on how one becomes a Nida? As I said, once she is a Nida, then it's irrelevant. Now all the rules apply. It's just how she becomes a Nida. You have a difference between Daraisa and Darabana. Okay. Yeah. Childbirth itself makes a woman a Nida, even if there's no blood. Yeah, that's correct. Usually there's blood, so it doesn't... Yeah. Okay, now we will move on to the second phase, the second of the five steps in Nida, in Hilchos Nida. And chronologically, that will be Harchakos, that will be the separation between men and women, between a husband and wife, I should say, when she is a Nida. And this is likely the second part, we'll get this done, and then we'll leave the rest for next week. Now, we know that you're not allowed to have any sort of a relationship, of a physical relationship in any way, with an Ereva, with a woman to whom you're not related. So with somebody else's wife, etc., that would be prohibited. That's across the board. Your wife who is a Nida, you are prohibited to. And therefore, the same rules that apply between you and somebody else's wife would apply between you and your own wife when she is a Nida. So for example, just like you can't kiss or hug somebody else's wife, you certainly can't kiss or hug your own wife when she is a Nida, because she is prohibited to you just like somebody else's wife is. However, there is one glaring exception, and that is that with somebody else's wife, you're not allowed to have yichud. You're not allowed to have seclusion. You're not allowed to be in a room alone with somebody else's wife. With your own wife, when she is a Nida, you are allowed to be in the same room alone with her, and even to sleep in the same room. And so, because of that, because of the fact that yichud is permitted, because seclusion is permitted, and because of the fact that you are familiar with each other, Chazal enacted many harchakos, many additional separations between a husband and a wife who is a Nida. These extra separations do not apply between a man and somebody else's wife. So the way it comes out then is that in many areas, the way you act with your own wife when she is a Nida is more stringent than the way you act with somebody else's wife. And those are the harchakos that we are about to discuss, the separations we're about to discuss. And I only have the Shulchan Aruch in front of me, so I don't forget any of them. There are many of them. We'll go through as many as we can. You will remind me if you remember any that I have forgotten. Number one is that it says one should not be Megil Rosh, which means one shouldn't be lightheaded with his wife who is a Nida. Now that does not mean that one is not allowed to smile, laugh, tell jokes, etc. to his wife who is a Nida. That's acceptable and probably preferred. What is prohibited, I would use the words to be flirtatious, to be playful. Those are words that I would use. That describes it a little bit better. That's what I would say is prohibited when one's wife is a Nida. That would not be acceptable. As you would imagine, those are the types of behaviors that bring to physical relationship, and therefore it should be avoided when she is a Nida. Of course, they cannot touch each other. And in addition to not being able to touch each other, you can't even hand anything back and forth between your wife and you. You can't hand thing one to the other. So in other words, if you're going to hand her something, you put it down, and then she picks it up. And that would be acceptable. But you cannot hand anything directly to your wife, or even throw something directly to your wife. That is prohibited when she is a Nida. Now, or vice versa. Now, there are a couple of exceptions to this. Number one is a child who is old enough to reach for the other spouse. So then if I'm holding my one-year-old is reaching for my wife, I can hand him to her. Because it's considered like the one-year-old and I together are handing the one-year-old to my wife. Because he's also participating in the act of reaching for my wife. If he is clinging to me and doesn't want to go to my wife, then it would be prohibited because he's not reaching for her. If it is an infant who is too young to reach, that would also be prohibited. But as soon as a child is old enough to reach and they are reaching, then that would be acceptable to hand the child back and forth. Yeah.
I mean, when it's very inconvenient, there are times where it's going to be very inconvenient to put the child down on the ground.
Extremely inconvenient. That's right. So what you do is, in those cases, is you place the infant down on a surface, any surface, on the table, whatever it is, and hold the infant. Don't let go, Chas v'Shalom. Always hold the baby, but place the baby down. So then there's a difference between, in other words, here, look, doing this is prohibited. Doing this, even though my hand is still on the pen, is permitted, because the pen is not on my hand, it's on the surface. that's permitted. The same thing with the infant. You can place the infant down, hold the infant, and then your wife take the infant from you. That would be acceptable. Now, there's another exception to this rule, which is a little bit cumbersome, but it's good to know. And this is a heter that comes from Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, Zichron Racha, and that is as follows. The issur is to hand from one to the other. Rabbi Yaakov held that one is allowed to take an item from your wife, or vice versa, your wife from you, if it's not from your hand. For instance, let's say there is a child in your wife's lap. So then, as long as you don't touch your wife, you can take from her lap. That would be acceptable. Or there's something on her shoulder. As long as you don't touch her and you don't touch her clothing, you can take the item from her shoulder. That would be also acceptable, because that's not considered taking from one hand to the other. He cautioned that this was only true when you take from, not to put back. So even though I could take the baby from her lap, I can't place the baby back down in her lap, or any other item, for that matter.
So,
same thing. One can take from the other as long as it's not from hand to hand. That would be acceptable, but not to put back. But you have to be careful not to touch each other or each other's clothing when you're doing that. Yes? I agree with you. I would not do that with somebody else's wife either. It would certainly be unusual, inappropriate. But in this case, I suppose that Rabbi Yaakov is saying is that it's not going between a husband and wife. That will not lead to anything more. That's what I assume he is saying. As we only technically speaking, it may be even permitted with somebody else's wife. That's what it sounds like he's saying. We don't do it because we are uncomfortable, as we should be. From God up is an oxymoron. Okay. Now, it is also prohibited to smell the perfume that your wife is wearing. Now, what does that mean? You have to walk around with a clothespin on your nose? No. But what it means is that you can't go. That would be unacceptable when she is in nida. If she's wearing perfume, you walk into the room, you smell the perfume, that's okay. But one should not go out of his way to smell the perfume of his wife when she is in nida. Well, that's a discussion. You see, in those days, they used to wear a kameya. They used to wear something around their neck that smelled, that was the perfume. These days, it's spritzed or sprayed or whatever it is. So, you see, in those days, that which was on her is now on the dresser. It's the same item. The same smelling thing is there. Today, it's maybe the same smell, but it's a different substance, because one's in the can, one's out of the can, one's in the bottle, one's out of the bottle. So, it's a little bit different. Many poskim are matur today. Okay. Now, let's talk about eating, which is the area that there are the most harkakos. The most separations are regarding eating, because Chazal understood that eating together is an intimate thing to do. That is why when a couple gets married in the yichud room, it's not just that they were fasting all day, but it is considered appropriate for them to eat together in the yichud room, because eating alone is considered to be intimate. And so Chazal, therefore, had many different harkakos that they instituted during the time of eating. So first of all, husband and wife cannot eat at the same table without some sort of heker, without some sort of a sign that warns them to stay away from each other. So what would be a sign that would warn them to stay away from each other? One could place something on the table in the eating area that is not normally on the table, a set of keys, for example, or something like that. I once taught a chassan in Kala, who later reported to me that his wife had a little vase, and she cut out a little stop sign and placed it in the vase, and that was their hecker. Okay, you can be creative all you want. That's right. So there can be something like that. You could be whatever you want to do. There is a hecker. Another type of hecker would be to switch places. If you normally sit in one seat to sit in a different seat, that would also be a hecker, some sort of a sign. Now, this rule of a heker applies, this is one of the very few exceptions. All of the harchakos of nida, all the separations, apply even when you're around other people. Chazal didn't give exceptions whether other people are there or not. Even though there's other people who are there and they may notice, you still have to keep the harchakos. But this one is the one exception, that is does not have to be kept if there are others around. So if there are guests or if there are older children who would notice, then this would not have to be done. A little child wouldn't apply, but a child who was old enough to understand what is going on, and the child himself would be a deterrent to anything that would happen, then it would not be necessary to have a heker, to have a sign at the table when they are eating. In the time of the Gemara, everybody knew when your wife was a Nida and when she was not. Because in the time of the Gemara, they wore one set of clothing when they were a Nida and a different set of clothing when they were not a Nida. Everybody knew. They just didn't know the night she was going to the mikvah. But the next day, everybody knew. So there's nothing wrong with someone else knowing whether your wife is a Nida or not. But this has to do with your own and your wife's sensitivities. That's really, it's not a halacha. It has to do with how comfortable you are. But there is nothing, it's not a lack of tznius if somebody knows that your wife is or is not a Nida. There could be exceptions to that. Maybe we'll get to that later. We'll see. Now, in addition to... Yes?
I think there'd be an exception if they could figure out in some way when she comes in.
That would be a problem. If they could figure out any... The problem is any time that anybody would figure out when a husband and wife plan on having marital relations. One of those times is going to the mikvah. That's a lack of tznius. But just because a woman is not a Nida doesn't mean they're going to have marital relations. So that just the fact that they know about it does not necessarily, it's not necessarily a lack of tznius. Now, the other harchakos that have to do with eating are that they cannot eat from the same plate. They cannot eat from the same ka'ara, from the same plate. Now, if there's a serving plate, and each one takes from the serving plate and puts on their own plates, which is the typical thing people do today, that's acceptable. But they should not eat or eat from the same plate or drink from the same cup. That would be a problem. Now, this comes up if, for example, you have a bag of chips, of pretzels, of popcorn, or whatever it is, or a bowl, and you're both eating from that container. That would be a problem, eating from the same plate, theoretically. What we would have to do is ensure that one of you is not eating directly from that container. So, for example, if there's a bowl of popcorn on the table, and we're both eating from it, one of us should take the popcorn and put it down on the table. So that one is eating from the bowl, and one is eating from the table. Or both of you put it down on the table, even though you're both eating from the table, that's not considered to be the same plate. It's a big table. One side of the table, the other side of the table. It's not called one plate just because they're both eating from the table. This can come up most frequently, if you think about it, in a driving situation. You're driving, your husband and wife sitting next to each other, and there's a bag between them that they're both eating from. They're going to get a little cumbersome. But one should, probably the non-driver, should put the food down before they eat it. Then that way, they're not eating from the same container. Yeah?
My understanding is once the woman is eating from that bowl, I'm not allowed to take any more from that bowl and even put it up.
Okay. Okay, so you're touching on the next thing, which is not to eat your wife's leftovers. You're not allowed to eat your wife's leftovers. Shiuri ma'achala, you can't eat her leftovers. She can eat your leftovers, but you can't eat her leftovers. It's the reverse of what is normally done, right? So you can't eat her leftovers. So if she has food on her plate and she's not finishing it, you can't eat her leftovers. Now, that's only true when the item is a one-person size. If you have a bowl where there's a lot of popcorn in there, then it's clearly for more than one person, then she doesn't acquire it. It's only when let's say you have a single serving of chips. Then, theoretically, that could be her bag of chips. But if it's a large bag, it's clearly a family size, then that what you're describing would not occur. Now,
So that means that
you still can't eat together from the same bag, but it's not considered to be her leftovers.
It's not hers.
You can take it out and put it out on the table and eat from the table. Well, right, if it's her bag, that's a problem. Or let's say a single 16-ounce, 12-ounce can of soda. The small cans of soda, 12-ounce, I guess. Right, it's a single serving, then you can't share that because it's hers. Now, before we take questions, let's just explain these two things. Eating from the same plate or drinking from the same cup and leftovers. eating from the same bowl or from the same plate, even if it's more than a one-person size, is prohibited. So even though it's a large bag of chips, you still can't eat together from the bag of chips. But that's only when you're eating together. If she eats from the bag of chips and now she's finished, and now you want to eat from the bag of chips, that's okay, because you're not eating together from the same plate or from the same container. Let me just finish this first. So that would be okay. It's only when you're eating together. Leftovers are a problem even when she's finished eating. She was eating, and now she's done. You can't eat her leftovers. However, there is an exception to the case of leftovers, and that is if the leftovers are transferred to another surface, they would be acceptable. So let's say she's eating, and she's drinking, and she doesn't finish what she has. You can pour her drink into your cup, or you can take the food off her plate and pour it onto your plate, and then you can eat the leftovers. So the prohibitions, again, are only eating the leftovers from her plate or her cup, even though she's done, but she's still sitting there, that will still be a problem. But you can move it to your plate or your cup, that will be okay. Or you can't eat together from the same container, even if it's a large amount, if you're eating at the same time. But if one is finished, the other one can eat. And again, she can eat your leftovers even without taking it off your plate. Okay, questions? Yeah. So then, if she's still sitting there, you can't eat from the bag, because that's her leftovers. If she leaves, then it's okay anyway. She left. Yeah. If she left.
It's not permanent.
Right. But if she's still there, then you can't eat from the leftovers in her bag, even though she's done eating, until you pour it out of the bag. Right. Yes. Once it's put away, then it's everything starts over. Back begins again. Okay. Doesn't apply to kids. It only applies to between husband and wife. Drink from it, then it's not a problem. That's right. Yeah. We'll try to find more leniencies as we go along.
I'm not sure one general question yet, but the topic earlier, you said that it's just like any other person's wife as far as who's an heir to you. And I'm asking because I had two different rabbis say different answers, and then the head rabbi gave a certain answer. The head rabbi is here, so I don't want to get him in trouble with the issue of hair cover. If your wife is custom, not in the house, not to keep her hair covered. Obviously, I'm going to see someone else's wife uncovered hair, but as you are teaching it.
Okay, we'll get to not just hair covering, but also being dressed, undressed, et cetera. We'll get that coming up, okay? Okay, now.
Are you still working on meals?
I was going to move on to something else, but go ahead. Okay, thank you. Yeah. I'll move to that now. I was going to do that later. Let's do that now. In addition to these things, neither husband nor wife can serve each other in the normal way, which means husband's sitting at the table and the wife brings in a bowl of soup and wants to put it down on his plate. That would be a problem. You can't serve each other food or drink normally. The only exception to this is water. Somebody wants to ask me, what about seltzer? Okay. But anyway, you can't serve each other food or drink in the normal way. Now, there are many ways to get around this, and that's what you got to do. You got to do one of the ways of getting around it. One way of getting around it is to serve with your weaker hand. If you're a righty, serve with your left hand. If you're a lefty, serve with your right hand. That is an acceptable difference. You wouldn't normally put the food down that way, I hope, particularly soup. So if you switch hands, that is one way of doing it. Another way of doing it is not to place the food directly where the person is eating. So if my plate is right here in front of me, where this shulchan aruch is, and my wife takes the bowl of soup and puts it down over here on the side of the table, then I need to take the soup and put it on my bowl, on my plate, then that would be okay. Because she didn't actually serve me, she put it down next to me, then I moved it over. That would also be okay. those would be okay to do as well. But this is both ways, wife to husband, husband to wife. You can't serve each other food or drink, as I said, except for water. So you can't pour each other drinks. That would also be a problem. Again, unless you pour into her cup, but you put the cup not where she's eating, like on the side, so she now needs to pick up the cup and move it back over to where she eats. That would be okay because you didn't really serve her. You put it over here. The problem is serving her directly. That is a problem. I think because water is considered to be so, there's no chashim, there's no importance to water. Nobody really thinks highly enough of water that it should have any great sense of. But
serving means whether or not you're staying,
No, no, if you're not at the table, it's okay. I mean, serving it to you at the table. You can serve it. Yeah. That's right. That's right. Thank you for pointing that out. If you get up and walk away from the table, either one of you, you can put it down on her plate. The point is serving her when she's there. That's right. Yeah. At the table. That's right. Okay. Now, wine is more stringent. Wine is more common. Because the, obviously, alcohol, or particularly wine, Chazal only really deal with wine, even though there are other alcoholic drinks, but they deal only with wine in this. But wine would be the item that could bring to lightheadedness the most. Therefore, with wine, there's an additional stringency. Now, this stringency only is from husband to wife, not from wife to husband. And that is that in addition to not being able to serve your wife wine, you can't even send her wine. So I cannot tell my son, here, take this cup of wine or grape juice and give it to Ima, give it to my wife. That you can't do because you're sending her wine or grape juice that you can't do. Now, this means that there is it's tricky with Kiddush, and that's what you're alluding to. Kiddush tends to be problematic. So there are several ways around this problem. The simplest way, and it really depends on what you do in your house anyway when you're serving Kiddush. If when you serve Kiddush, you pour into many little cups and then you just pass the cups around the table, that's okay, because there's nothing designated for your wife. So there are seven people around the table, you pour seven cups, and now it goes around the table, your wife gets one of them, that's okay. Even if, let's say I pour the first cup, and then I hand the first cup to the person sitting on my left. Now, in most homes, you know what you're going to do with that cup. You're going to give it to the person's wife. But I didn't tell him to do that. I just gave it to him, and he decided to send it down to my wife. So I didn't send it to my wife. So that would also be acceptable, because I didn't send her anything. Just because the person sitting to my left decided that it was going to my wife, that doesn't mean I sent it to her, and that would also be okay. There are other ways of doing it. Some people I've seen in some people's homes where the husband, after he makes Kiddush, he'll pour some of the wine out. He'll sit down and begin drinking, and the wife will actually dole it out. That also solves the problem because she's serving herself. That would also be acceptable. If you have no way around it and you're embarrassed or whatever it is and you have to send things around and you have to send a particular cup to your wife, then she can take that cup and pour it into another cup. That would also be okay. Because if you send her a cup and she pours it into another cup, and it's like you didn't send her a cup. It's like you sent her a bottle. You can send her a bottle of wine, and then she'll pour it into her cup and drink it. You just can't send her the cup that she's going to drink from. So if she pours it out into another cup, that would also be okay. That's okay. You can send her the pitcher, and then she'll pour it into her cup. That's okay too. Right. That's another acceptable method. Yeah, then she can do it, because you didn't pour it for her. Yeah, if you have that custom, that your wife drinks from your own cup, that would be okay. Because I drank from the cup, and I put it down, which means I didn't pour it for her, I poured it for me. Then I put it down, and as we said, there's no problem with the wife eating from the husband's leftovers, so then she could drink that cup of wine as well. That would be acceptable. You have a question? That's okay. So then you didn't send it to her. She took it. That's okay.
You get a choice.
Makes it easier. Okay. That, I believe, covers the eating harchakos. Okay. Sitting and sleeping, sitting and lying down. One is not allowed to sit or lie down. Certainly not to lie down, but even to sit on a bed that is specific to his wife. Now, if it's his wife's bed, when she is in nida, then he is not allowed to lie down or even to sit on her bed. That is prohibited. Even if she's not in the room. The only exception to this is if she's out of town. But even if she's not even in the house, but she's in town, then you cannot lie down or even sit down on her bed. It is permitted for a wife to sit down or even lie down on her husband's bed. However, if her husband is in the room, she should not lie down on his bed. She can sit down on his bed, but she should not lie down on his bed when he is in the room because of what it may make him think about. So the again, a husband cannot lie down or even sit down on his wife's bed, even if she's not there, as long as she's in town. A wife should not lie down on her husband's bed when her husband is there in front of her husband. This does not apply to, let's say, a chair that is designated for one or the other. Let's say a wife has a rocking chair that she likes. The husband is allowed to sit in that rocking chair. It's only on a bed that this prohibition applies.
And a man can sit in his wife's chair.
A wife can't sit in his wife's chair.
A man can sit in his wife's chair.
A man can sit in his wife's chair. Yes. Yeah, that would be fine. Okay, we'll get to make a bed in a moment. Yes? So she didn't, you mean you weren't in the room, she lay down, she fell asleep, and then you came into the room. Yeah, so that means, you don't, no, don't wake her up. Walk out of the room. don't wake her up.
Okay. It's time to go to sleep.
Yeah, well then you're stuck, because you can't lie down in her bed.
Yeah.
So, either the couch or...
Require my bed.
Huh?
So she doesn't basically require my bed.
You're saying because now,
she's laying in the bed,
yeah.
The whole issue is not to become excited.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Now she's lying in the bed and putting down, there she is.
Yeah, okay. I agree with you. It wouldn't be the best scenario. I would agree with you that it'd be, I think a person has to know themselves how they'll react in that case. But you're right, it wouldn't be the best thing. I agree with you. Okay, now a husband and wife should not be sitting or lying, not just lying, but even sitting on a surface that when you sit on it with another person, you feel the other person moving around. In other words, let's say certainly lying or even sitting together on the same bed, even if it's not her bed, that would be a problem because when one moves, you can feel the other one move. Or let's say you have a swinging, one of those swinging, what do you call them, like on the front porch?
Bench
or whatever. Yes, yeah. One of them. Huh? One of those things, whatever, you know what I'm talking about.
Glider.
A glider, right, one of those things. So that would also be a problem because when one moves, you can feel the other one move. So that's a problem. That is a problem unless there is someone between them. But if there's no one between them, they should not be on a surface that moves like that. Now there is an exception to this, and that is if they are traveling for a mitzvah. If they're traveling, that's wrong. If they're traveling for a need, in other words, not traveling for pleasure. If they're traveling for a need, most of the time when we travel, it's for a need. Even visiting family is usually for a need. So when you're traveling for a need, then it's okay. Then this is waived. And that's because Chazal understood that when you travel, it's much more difficult to decide where you're going to sit, where you're not going to sit. And so if you're traveling for a need, the cases in Chazal are sitting in a horse and buggy, a wagon, which bumps around. You can easily feel each other move. Or on a, let's say, a small boat. Where when one moves, the other one moves. If you're traveling for a need, that would be okay. But if you're just going boating as a trip, one should not be in a small boat with his wife, where the boat is moving around. You can feel each other move, unless there's someone between them. As part of this, a husband and wife may not lie down in the same bed. So they should not share a bed when she is in need. And that's the reason why from people have two beds. Now, how far apart do the beds have to be when she is in need? So there is the letter of the law, and then there is what is preferable. The letter of the law is even a minuscule amount is acceptable. As long as the two beds are not touching each other, then it is okay. They can be in two separate beds. There is a Zohar that says that the bed should be far enough apart. There should be an arm's length apart. That's right, an arm's length apart. So that if you reach your arm over the bed, you wouldn't touch the other one's bed. That is the preferred amount. The custom seems to be to try to do that if one can. But if one cannot do that, like for example, let's say you're visiting someplace and they were nice enough to give you two beds, which isn't always the case, but they did give you two beds, but there's no room to move the beds apart. Then that would be okay, because the letter of the law is as long as you have them even a little bit separated, that is okay.
Can they be on the same box spring?
That really, I'm not 100% sure. That, to me, depends. I mean, to me, that would depend on whether you feel each other move, I would imagine. Yeah. Yes, that's the next thing. If they give you one bed, then one of you, and it will be you, gets the floor. Okay. I've had it too. Don't worry. Who will be the first? Okay, bunk beds, it depends how sturdy they are. This is discussed, and don't laugh. On two occasions, my wife and I were visiting someplace and we were given a bunk bed. And so it depends how sturdy it is. If it's sturdy enough that it doesn't shake, then it will be okay. If it does, then again, you get the floor. Okay, that's with beds. Now it's not really in style anymore to have this, so it's not so common. But the couches that used to have one cushion that would go across the whole couch could also theoretically be this problem, because you're sitting on the same surface, one moves, you feel the other one move. If it's separate cushions, even if it's the same, I don't know what you call it, the frame is the same frame, but it's separate cushions, that's really the case of the back spring and the separate mattresses. And generally speaking, that's okay because they're separate cushions. You may feel a little bit, but the amount you're feeling is nothing really to take into account, and therefore it would be okay most of the time in that case. Yeah, then it would be better not to sit on the same cushion as her. That's correct. Unless there's somebody between you, right? That's right.
And that's going to be your child.
Yes. He shouldn't be close to the other woman if he's not related to her. But you know, if they're not near each other, that would be okay. Obviously, look, you know, there's as Rabbi Vogler brought before, when there are things that make a person uncomfortable because it's somebody else's wife, that's a good thing. It should make a person uncomfortable. And if you're uncomfortable, then don't fight it. Just, you know, don't do it. And that's right. But we're talking about, you know, the letter of the law. What is necessary. I saw it brought down. I had the Shiloh. I saw it brought down.
Yeah.
I think in that case, it's better that the man be on the floor. It's such a rare case, the bunk beds. I know it happened to me twice, but still, it's not such a common thing. I don't want to get into the nitty-gritty of it. You know, ask your rub, you know. Okay. Now, let's talk about clothing. And, yes? We'll get into that later. Okay? I hope we'll have time for that. What about clothing? So we asked before about covering hair. So let's talk about clothing in general. It is permitted for a woman to see her husband undressed when she is in nida. It is not permitted for a man to see his wife undressed when she is in nida. Now, what is considered undressed? What is prohibited? What is permitted? So how dressed would she have to be? Meaning, what is permitted? It means that if she is as dressed as a woman would normally be when she's in the house alone with her husband, let's say at night. I don't mean going to sleep. I mean, just around the house. In other words, we're not talking about knees, elbows, collarbone, the whole business of tznius. That's not what we're talking about over here. We're talking about what is generally covered for a woman when she is alone with her husband and just walking around the house. That is the amount that beyond that is what he's not allowed to look at when she is a nida. Now, this rule, and this was pointed out to me by my chassid teacher, this rule is a rule on the husband. You can't look. It's not a rule on your wife. It's not that she can't change in the room. It's that you can't look. So it's not her problem to ensure that you should be able to look at her. It's your problem to make sure that you don't look when she is changing or whatever she has to do. What about covering hair? So this I will defer to Rabbi Feldman. I mean, he said you already spoke about it, so I'm not. Okay, then Birshus the Rav. The hair, so Again, it will follow the same criterion, meaning that if she normally covers her hair in the house, meaning when she's around her husband, she covers her hair, and she goes to sleep with her hair covered, that's what she normally does, then you would not be allowed to look at her hair when she's in Nida, because it's normally covered all the time when she's around you. If she normally does not cover her hair around her husband, when they're alone in the house, then she doesn't cover her hair, then it would be okay, because it's like anything else that is normally uncovered when she's around her husband.
Rabbi Miller has been teaching a class during this time of the year, and he had mentioned covering the hair. I didn't ask then because I was just learning, but when I went back to my wife, she says, that's not what she learned. She asked me to ask differently, and then the rabbis all talked, and I could be concerned when you told me at the end of our
The referees conferred. Say it's okay there. Yeah, because you're used to seeing it with your hair uncovered. Okay. A woman singing when she is in Nida. Can you listen to your wife sing when she is in Nida? I once had a friend of mine once asked my Rebbe, Tzvi Berkowitz, this question, and he said, does she have a nice voice? essentially, this will follow the rules of Kol Isha, which is that you're not supposed to listen to another woman sing, a woman who you're not related to sing, but the Rama says, in Hilchos Kriyas Shema, the Rama writes that Kol HaRagil, a voice that you're used to hearing, is okay. And therefore, practically speaking, we have no newlyweds here in the room, so as long as if you're used to your wife singing, then it will be okay when she is in Nida. If you've never heard her sing before, or it's a newlywed or whatever, then it could be a problem until you get used to it. It's like we're saying Talamantar.
Like
we're saying Talamantar.
That's what you say.
Okay. A few more points. We have to finish it up because we have to get to the second half of this class. And that is... let's talk about making beds. Somebody asked about it before. A husband is allowed to make his wife's bed when she is in Nida. You can't get out of that. A wife should not make her husband's bed in front of her husband. It goes into Hatzas Hamita. There's a Tosfos that discusses this, that it's not exactly this, but still, the minhag seems to be machmir that she shouldn't make his bed when she is in Nida. In addition, it is usur, is prohibited for a woman to bathe her husband when she is in Nida, even washing his hands, feet, and face. So that would mean, for example, he puts out his hands and she washes his hands. That would be, she's not touching him. She's just pouring the water on his hands. That should not be done when she is in Nida. Included in that is drawing a bath. Baths aren't so fashionable these days, but drawing a bath, which means she'll get the water ready for him, that would also be a problem if he is there, if it's in front of him. I'm just looking too quickly here to make sure we didn't miss anything. Okay, somebody asked before about sickness. Sickness, yeah.
I'm a little confused. I thought you said he couldn't touch her bed.
He can't sit or lie on her bed. He can touch her bed. Yeah, when you're making the bed, don't fall over. Right. Okay, so sickness is a little bit tricky. There are many exceptions when either spouse is sick. So rather than getting into the details over here, I will say that if there is a sickness and one needs to help out, then one should ask their Rav. There are many exceptions, many loopholes because of sickness. Chazal recognize when one of the spouses are sick, then it's much more difficult to deal with the harchakos, and therefore there are many exceptions, and then a Rav should be consulted. I don't remember any others. Is there anything else here that we've missed that we should mention? Anybody think of anything that we didn't cover? I think that's the basic thing. Okay, so at this point, as I said, we have covered the first two parts of Hilchos Nida, how she becomes a Nida, and the harchakos, the separation between husband and wife when she is a Nida. There are three other parts which lead out, we will cover next week, and they are there's Shiva Nikim, there's seven clean days, which includes the 5 days, which we'll talk about, going to the mikvah, and then Vestas calculating when she anticipates getting her next period. And now I will give the floor over to Rabbi Feldman, who will deal with the Hashka. Do you mind being taped?
No, I don't like being taped because I like to change the setup.
Okay.
I'm sure you can tell that Rabbi Pansky is a master at being concise, clear, and organized. And that's something that only comes from mastery. So we appreciate it very, very much. And also for just putting this together. I apologize, not to you, but to the whole group. I came like 4 or 5 minutes late. That's because I've been sitting downstairs waiting for the thing to start. I was wondering how. Even Rabbi Pansky's late. So, I came upstairs to my office for a minute, I walked back down, and anyway, so I apologize, just in terms of the genius of the thing, I wanted to be here when we began. I don't know, did you give any words of introduction to the whole shepherding at all? Okay, so this, by the way, this effort of revealing Hanukkah is consistent with the general approach that during these weeks, during the Shavuot, Shmos, Va'era, Go, B'Shalach, Yisrael, that one reviews the Hilchos Nida and also Stam Inyanim of the relationship between husband and wife. And part of it certainly is that, and we can see this in a more profound way, that the time of Geula, the time of the relationship, of the courtship between Kadosh Baruch Hu and Klal Yisrael, Kol Dovi Neza Ba, voice of my beloved is coming with that leg al harim, skipping over the mountains, which is the whole idea that Kadosh Baruch Hu speeded up, hurried up the cakes and brought the geula and formed the relationship with the Kaiser, the Tesi, the Kisalti, the Velakati, etc. That is the metaphor, so to speak, of that's the ultimate relationship. Therefore, our relationship, the key relationship in our lives also is refreshed. And the way that our relationships are defined, are specifically defined context of halacha, and therefore, during this period of time, this undertaking is that. So, thank you, Rabbi Pansky, for making this possible and for creating the opportunity for us to connect this way. And I want to acknowledge everybody here because you're a self-selecting group, because every single male in the city of Atlanta had a chance to be here tonight, and you're the ones who chose to be here. So, obviously, that means there's something significant that you see in it, and I hope it's worth your time. I want to start with the Gemara, with which you may be familiar. The Gemara talks about the Maisa of David HaMelech when he was digging the Shisin to prepare the area for the Beis HaMikdash, the Makom HaMikdash. So the Gemara says that B'Shah Shekar David Shisin, when David dug these Shisin, Kapa Tehaima. So the depths, the deep waters started rising up. Ba'ala Mishpat Da'ama. They wanted to drown out. They sought to drown out the world. Amar. So David HaMelech said, Mahalich Toshim Achaspa. What would be the din about writing the name of HaKadosh Baruch Hu on a piece of a shard, a piece of cheres, Mishpat Da'ama, and throw it into the depths? The Lake Adutu, that the water should remain in their place. So Lake Da'ama Le'midi. Nobody answered him what the halach would be. So Amar, so he said, anybody who knows this halacha and doesn't come forward, so to speak, he should choke. So Nasakitofel, his Rebbe, and this is why David Amel was so careful about this, because he was in front of his Rebbe, that's why he was asking. So Nasakitofel Kabachomer Ba'atzmo. Nasakitofel made a Kabachomer. He said, Amar, Ma'ala is the Shalom in Ishla Ishto. If to make Shalom between husband and wife, Amar HaTara, the Torah says, Shemish, and if the Mekadusha, Himacha, Alamayim, that my name, which is written Mekadusha, should be erased onto the water of the Meisota in order when a husband is Mekana against his wife. And the ritual calls for the Kayin to scrape the Parsha, which has the Kodesh Baruch Hu's name, into the water that the Saita drinks. So the Kodesh Baruch Hu, the Kodesh Baruch Hu, certainly for the entire world, which is going to be drowned out by these waters, certainly would be allowed to do what David HaMelech wanted to do. Malay, so he said, Shari, he said, it's mutter. So let's go, Achitov made this Kavacham, and then he said, okay, David HaMelech, it's mutter. So Kaz Hashem HaChaspa, Shari HaTahimla, he wrote the name on this shard. He threw it into the depths, nachas v'kamaduchte. So the waters went down and went back to their place. And the Gemara in Sukkah, which is the Gemara in Sukkah also in the Gimel, the Gemara mentions more, and this is probably worth mentioning just for a second. The Gemara mentions that it went down, that it went so far down, David HaMelech said, wait a minute, there's not going to be any moisture for the topsoil. So he brought it up. That's the whole Gemara there, and Sukkah goes into greater detail, the Shir HaMalos, which are 15 malos, that's how he brought up the water out of the 16,000 amos that it had sunk, that it went down, he brought it up 15, so it was only 1,000 below, and therefore the earth was able to get that natural moisture, and therefore it was conducive to growth. Now, so we on the surface, we have over here that HaKadosh Baruch Hu allows his name for the relationship of husband and wife there to be erased, therefore, certainly, he says, Achitofel can be done over here to save the world. But I believe that we have something here much more profound about that. It gives us an insight into what it is that causes the Kodesh Baruch Hu, first of all, to use his name of all things to bring husband and wife together, and why that would be the source of this din over here of stopping the waters from destroying the world. It seems that David HaMelech, in digging the Shisin, evidently exposed, the Gemara is saying, he exposed a natural force. It's like a natural force that's being unleashed. The waters came and they were going to flood the world. One would assume further that this natural force is the original force that had the waters covering the earth before HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and the Bria said that Yikava Hamayim HaMakamachad, and so on and so forth. And therefore the waters over here, somehow David HaMelech is digging these shisim, these holes for the Nesachim, and it released that force, so to speak. And so David HaMelech has to find a way to control and contain and defy this force. So Achitofel says that if HaKadosh Baruch Hu used his name for the relationship of Ish l'Ishto, so certainly it could be done over here, West Peshat, that there also, there is this natural force that unleashed, that uncontained, could actually be destructive. And the way we could say this is, that the shame of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is actually the source of everything. In other words, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's shame is the ultimate description of reality. Right? It's the only thing, actually, that describes reality. And the shame is the source of the whole Bria. When HaKadosh Baruch Hu makes the world, he makes the world to reflect his essence, so to speak. Out of his name, so to speak, comes the whole world. So the relationship between husband and wife is fixed, is repaired, is brought back together by the shame of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which means that in the relationship between husband and wife, we actually have the purpose of the Bria realized. In the same way that HaKadosh Baruch Hu ordains that certain forces be separated, and that the waters be at the depths that they are, and not overcome the whole world, so too HaKadosh Baruch Hu actually ordains that there be a certain kind of a relationship between husband and wife. And that is actually the plan, so to speak, the plan with a capital P. Meaning that when we talk about Shalom Bayis, we're talking about not a way to get along. We're not talking about a way to manage. We're not talking about, we have to be married, and it's not nice to be married to somebody that you don't get along with, and it doesn't work well for the kids, or it's not pleasant, or you don't grow as much, or that kind of a thing. It's something much more basic. This Gemara suggests to us that it's a much more essential concept of Shalom Bayis, which is that it's actually a reflection of the purpose of the Bria itself, and the place that we are going to realize the purpose of the Bria itself is going to be in the relationship that we have being Ish to Isha. One of the things that occurs in the context of a relationship between husband and wife is the fulfillment of the Tzelem Elokim. It's really the fulfillment of the divine image. It's a fulfillment of the reflection of HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the world. How does that happen? What is that? What is this? What is this reflection? Why is the Shechina Shruya between husband and wife? Why is there a Shechina that's between husband and wife? What is this about? The idea, I think, is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in creating the relationship of Adam and Chava, or Ish v'Ishto, issues an invitation to human beings. And the invitation is very technical, but it's also much more general, much broader. The invitation is to be a partner with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in being a creator. Which is an awesome thing. Think about it. There can only be one creator. There can only be one source. And creativity should really only be with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And yet HaKadosh Baruch Hu created human beings and actually invited us to participate with him in creating human beings. Right? And the way we do that is in the context of the relationship between the Ishtar. Now I say it's a very technical invitation because it has to do with children, but it's also a much more general invitation because it's really the tsura, it's the blueprint for broader participation in the world. And in other words, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is saying that in the same way that I invite you to participate in physical creativity, I also invite you to participate in the broader sense of creativity and being masters of the world and actually being my partners in maintaining the world and in building the world and in helping the world realize its purpose as a bore. So we're talking again, just to create the context here for this kind of discussion, when we're talking about the relationship between husband and wife, we're talking about the relationship that is going to be the arena in which we're going to notice our similarity to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So if you think about it that way, we're talking in a sense of very high when we talk about issues of Shalom Bayis, because this is an unbelievably potent opportunity. Our access to being similar to HaKadosh Baruch Hu comes in the context of the relationship between husband and wife. And the other way, to the degree that we demean it, dismiss it, ignore it, reduce its significance by just surviving it or not really being willing to bring ourselves to the relationship in a way that really adds to the relationship, to the degree that we try to minimize it, to that degree, we are avoiding an opportunity, the opportunity to be to develop ourselves as reflections of HaKadosh Baruch Hu and partners with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So I think it's important for us to see the struggle, which is Shalom Bayis, and it is that. It does not come naturally. It's something that has to be forged. It never comes naturally. That's the beauty of the thing. It has to actually be worked on, and it has to, we have to summon strengths that we don't normally have, that we wouldn't naturally have. So this is really an opportunity. It's not a problem that we somehow have to muddle through or avoid if we can and not avoid if we can't, but it's actually an amazing opportunity. It's an opportunity for us to really realize the purpose that we're created. And the surah that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created for us to realize the reason that we're created is the relationship between husband and wife. All of which is to say that we should realize that the challenges that come in the relationship are actually designed for a purpose. Let me put it this way, in the context of Hilchos Nida. You know, we tend to think of a paradigm in Halacha called Nida as an exercise. we tend to think of it as kind of like training for perhaps proper physical relationships with husband and wife. What's the training? That we have a period of time when we don't relate physically. Since we can't relate physically, we have to relate some other way. So by relating some other way and by forging pathways of connection to our wives that are not physical, physically intimate, so that develops a greater strength in relationship, and therefore when there is a physical relationship, that physical relationship is enhanced by the work, so to speak, or by the realization, not necessarily the work, but the realization that one gains when one relates during the time when we're not physical, when we're not sexual with our wives. So all of that is probably true, but we have to realize something. Because Rabbi didn't make women a nida so that we can learn how to be a mensch. Right? In other words, it's to say that the whole concept of nidos is brought into the world so that we can just learn how to be better people. It's a little rough when I saw it, yes.
Very good.
Yes, on its own merits, and I'm going to address that as well. So why is that? I'm saying, why are you raising that as a comment?
Because of what you're saying. You were talking about it in the positive, and I thought it had come about.
I would say that even on its own merits, what you're describing is self-control as a result of Nida is the beginning of other avoda. In other words, what self-control is something which uncontrolled is destructive, and when that control is present, then there's an opportunity for other more positive development. Okay. And what I'm suggesting, though, is that there's something essential about the concept of nida. In other words, that if we're going to say, as we opened with, that the relationship between husband and wife is actually the opportunity to discover our likeness to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and to imitate and cooperate with him and participate with him as partners in creativity, then it would follow that the paradigm that HaKadosh Baruch Hu sets up for us in our relationship with our wife actually is going to follow the paradigm that we would have with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And so by this, I want to establish the notion that we were just talking about ahakas, richuk, distance in relationship is actually part of relationship. That the concept of ebb and flow, shall we say, of the of relationship, closeness and distance, is actually something which is part of our relationship with the Kodesh Baruch Hu as well. Or to put it another way, relationship by definition is dynamic. Relationship is never static. Anytime you notice that you are absolutely the same with somebody, you're not in a relationship with them. I have the exact same relationship with the President of the United States that I've had for the last 6 years. Okay? Actually, it's not true. I like him the day I was in the White House with him. But anyway, and the relationship changed as the distance grew. But okay, I have the same exact relationship with the Vice President of the United States that I've had for the last 6 years, right? It has not changed at all, okay? I have different opinions about it, but my relationship is the same. Why? Because I have no relationship, right? The point is that any relationship, by definition, is dynamic because it has to do with two beings, two independent beings that are dealing with each other. By definition, it's going to be movement. You take two stationary objects and you put them in relationship with each other and move them, that it's impossible. It doesn't, it's never the same. So therefore, there's going to be rechuk and there's going to be kiruv. There's going to be closeness. Yes.
But following that argument, the husband-wife relationship does not end with menopause. So nida's not forever, and the relationship still continues for a long time after that.
And there are people who have no period at all.
Right.
And there are people who are always in nida. Right? I mean, you're right. Yeah, you're right. So I think for the purpose of this discussion, we can say that the paradigm that generally governs the relationship, particularly during the time of maximum creativity, okay, would be the one that we're looking at as a paradigm. Okay, you're right, there are phases, there are, and so on and so forth. And even there, that would be after, it's interesting, because metapartum happens after the training, so to speak, or after the establishment of the pattern. So at that point, so to speak, one could argue that the couple is already acclimated to the, what's that?
They're already an old couple.
that's not what I was saying, but I get the joke. All right, so, so the idea is that that Rishchuk is part of it. If you think about it, that's our relationship to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Klal Yisrael itself, and the relationship to HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the same thing. Starting from the beginning, we got Eglin and Olam Haba, and immediately there's Golas, and there's expulsion, and there's Rishchuk. Klal Yisrael itself is considered to be a Kain and Nidah Hayasa, right? So Klal Yisrael itself is compared to a Nidah, which means that in our connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we have periods of distance and periods of closeness. Now, the periods of distance are not like problems, like they shouldn't be. The periods of distance are not that there's a mistake and we have to get over the mistake. The periods of distance actually are by design. They actually have a purpose. And not only that, it's the distance that creates the closeness. The distance itself is what makes the closeness, A, appreciated. Number two is, in the distance is the access to the closeness. The tikkun of the distance is actually what creates the closeness. If we follow that paradigm to the relationship between husband and wife, governed by Hilchos Nida, we have, I think, some new insights. We have some new opportunities here, which is that, number one is, let's start with the most pashut and, I would say, basest common notion, which is downtime, that's survival time. That's get through time, that's okay, that's some other time, that's not relationship time. Downtime, not Nida time, that's she devolves into her orbit, I devolve into my orbit. Hopefully we both get busy, time goes fast, it's always hard, she's nuts, whatever the language is, I'm talking on the basis level. And then that relationship doesn't happen at this point. Then relationship resumes perhaps, during times where physical intimacy is allowed. Of course, there's a basic falsehood in that because a person can't have a relationship of meeting with somebody only at a certain time and have a relationship of no meeting at another time. It's not full illusion. Relationship during the physical time is really not that. But more than that, the point is that during the time of Rishchuk, of physical distance, what we're doing is we're actually living through part of the paradigm of our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And therefore, there's what to discover there. There's something available there, which means we're still engaged intensely in a relationship. It's just on a different footing, and it has different goals and different purposes. And so what it means is that a person in a relationship is always open, is always thinking, is always engaged, is always being challenged, is always thinking, is always seeing it as part of part of the relationship. And so we have to appreciate that what goes on during the period of grief is actually significant for the entire relationship, not only in terms of in order what it allows to happen later on, that if there's a decent relationship during the time of distance, then the time of physical intimacy will be even more meaningful and be an expression of something like that. Not only that, that's one level, but on a much more profound level, the growth that's available in a marriage is available during all times, during all phases, and the phase of Rishchuk, the phase of physical distance, is also significant. I chose to address this issue first because in my limited experience, which is a false humility way of saying it, a great vast experience that I've had, but I realize that it's more limited than others, so it is limited. In my limited experience, I find that we somehow think we have a difficult time engaging, we men have a difficult time engaging this kind of a discussion because we think that we're a problem. We know we're a problem. We're sure we're a problem. We're told that we're a problem. And therefore, we relate to this whole issue as if there's something wrong with us. Because somebody is always unhappy with us because we're always failing during this period of time, and we're always told that. And so we, okay, what can I do? I'm not gonna make anybody happy, just whatever, I'll do the best I can, and it's hopeless anyway. And so there's a reticence to discuss the whole thing. So I wanna change the whole context, so to speak, and have people realize that it actually is an opportunity, and it actually is something that that gives us what we really want in life, which is growth, connection to others, growth, and connection to the people that we've committed our lives to, which specifically our wife. So, in that context, I think we can have perhaps a healthier discussion of some of the challenges that go on, some of the difference, some of the opportunities that happen during this period of time. First of all, what time is it? I want to address
9:30.
We're going to finish right now, so I'm going to go customarily like 2 more minutes, okay, to be good to being late. So, SNEAS is a very important issue for us to understand. SNEAS is the emphasis on essence. That's really what SNEAS is. SNEAS is the it's the emphasis on what's real, as opposed to what's not real. SNEAS is a desire to live in the olokapuni, which is the world of a reality, the world of the essence of what we are, as opposed to the external and superficial. So, when it comes to the physical relationship between man and wife, there is a tremendous power, and I would say a tremendous tendency to cater to and to relate to the external, which means that it's possible for a person, given the power of the sexual relationship, given the drive of the sexual relationship, it's possible for a person to actually see that as the definition of the relationship, whereas the sexual relationship has an external component and it has an internal component. The SNEAS is the attempt to reveal the inner dimension and to diminish, reduce in significance the outer dimension. And the opportunity to do that comes specifically when that dimension is eliminated. So during the period of Rishpa, during the period of distance, what's happening is that the optical illusion of the externality of the relationship is removed, so that what's left is the real thing, the real deal. And that's what's always there. Even when the physical relationship is also there, that's really what's always there, except that it's very easy for that optical illusion to prevail and to dominate to an extent that a person loses any reference, any relationship to the old, maybe to his inner world, to his into who he really is, and to who the relationship really is. And so, again, the harchakos, the isurim, are actually an opportunity for us to focus on the concept of olafim. I would say that a person practicing chuppas nida really has a leg up on the struggles that any decent and moral human being, or havdil, a non-Jew, would have in today's society. Well, today's society, it is very, very difficult. I would say impossible, but I would give somebody some shelter, say difficult. Theoretically, everybody can claim that they're actually succeeding. But it's very difficult to escape the overwhelming onslaught of raw, superficial externality in the area of sexuality in this world, as well as that. I don't need to list all the different avenues where that make it so difficult. But a person who is in the paradigm of following the halakhos, living a life of governed by of the mitzvahs, has a tremendous opportunity to remind himself constantly that that there is actually an inner world, and that the world of sexuality threatens to create out of us just superficial creatures who live only for the world of the external. So all of the struggles that we have, all of the challenges that we have in the context of a marriage are actually wonderful opportunities. And that's what I wanted to say by way of opening, so to speak. Next week, what I want to do, we assume we'll, we're not sure, Kansky and I will have to negotiate what we'll do next week. But I left for next week the discussion of some of the practicalities and some, and also I think some of the essential differences between husbands and wives, or men and women, I should say, and how that plays out in the relationship and what can, in certain ideas and approaches that could be better than some relates of growth. Anything that anybody would like to see addressed? Yes?
You're saying that how is the question as far as like saying the groups of relationships are straight to the sexual relationship and just coming out of the position that this whole relationship. Is there any way how you would explain the why would Hashem gave us the creativity of creating a business great pleasure?
Okay, so I'm not sure I'm going to... Let me phrase the question before I answer it. Okay, I want to answer the question, but I want to answer your question. It's tantalizing to be close to somebody else looking at that. So you're asking, that given that the real relationship is obviously in the domain of the penis, and given, therefore, that the sexual dimension actually threatens to overwhelm that and distract us. I'm not saying that at all. I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying the whole zivug per se is for the purpose of being created. And yes, sexuality actually is the vehicle through which physical creativity happens. But if you're creating children, you're creating humans, not children, say humans. So, I don't agree with that extra little link, which is that sexuality is therefore only superficial. What I'm saying is the koach, the taiva involved in the physical relationship has the potential. It's dafka the potential to distract a person from the penis, which is actually what makes it possible for a person to grow into the olam hapnimi by using it properly. So it's just the opposite. It's actually the strike, the seeking of a balance that would that really makes a difference. So I don't see it as a stira. I don't see it as a stira at all. It's just the opposite. Here's not your question. Here's what I was going to do. The reason Tavas Hamin is so strong is because it is the power of being as rubber, so to speak. It's not just the Gemara says that without that, so, you know, the Olam wouldn't be the Mishkayim. But we have to understand that. The fact is that a Kodesh Baruch Hu instills in a human being a power which is similar to a Kodesh Baruch Hu himself. So we would expect